This morning, as we continue the series on life and death, we've now come to that one part of our life that is going to be down at the very end, the pinpoint at the very end that is known as death. Each time we have demonstrated or illustrated that our life can be charted out with a line. And back here is the time that we were born, and then we have gone through and we have looked at the various aspects that we have during our youthful years. We have made mention of some of the things in mid-years. Then the last lesson we dealt with the problem of growing old. Now the Bible teaches that there is the end of life that is down here that we would call old age or aging, and some of the problems that deal with that. Now then today we want to go to that very dot that we have been looking at all this period of time and talk about the subject of death itself. Obviously we know as we turn to the very creation of man, the Lord put man in the Garden of Eden and gave him a tree that he forbade to eat of, and he said, "The day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die." When man violated God's law, then he did begin his physical death, and certainly he had his spiritual death on that occasion. We also understand in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27, the record says, "For it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment." And so death, then, is something that comes upon every creature that God has made. And yet, even though it is something that happens to every man, it seems as though it is the one event in our life that we try to deny and not look at. And so it is very, very important for us to live a well-rounded, godly life, for us to think about death before that period of time actually comes. Now today, our lesson is going to be a little differently than what it normally is. As all of you know, I always like to begin with the Bible, preach the Bible, and end with the Bible, and deal with it all the way through the lesson. However, there are some subjects that need to be dealt with by giving some advice in the experiences of man. For instance, if we were going to preach on the subject of marriage, we would not only go to those passages of Scripture that tells about marriage, but also give some personal observations about what a man ought to do in order to love his wife, or the woman ought to do in order to love her husband. And so today, then, we're going to be giving some exhortations along the line of what takes place when a man actually dies. Now, I don't know whether I will be able to preach the entire lesson today. We may have to break it and go half today and half next Lord's Day. I would like to be able to put it all together in one lesson. But what we're going to do is, first of all, go look at the death from human experience itself and see what happens to a person when they enter into that trauma that is known as death. And then we want to go to the Bible and we want to see God's answer to man's problem as man is dying. Now, first of all, I want to suggest to you that in the studies of man, there really are five or six different stages that an individual goes through when it comes to the part of his dying. Now, there is a book that I'm going to be referring to quite often here. It is this book, On Death and Dying, by Elizabeth Kubler Ross. Now, I would like to recommend this book to you for this reason. It is the only book, to my knowledge, that has been written on the subject of what takes place to a human emotion when people die. This is a nurse that determined that she would go into the wards of where people were dying, and she would interview them when they had been told, or before they had been told, really, about their terminal illness, and try to see what type of a trauma does an individual go through when they are told that their life on this earth has come to an end. For instance, if a person has cancer, the doctor has diagnosed it and he has given up all hope, then what does go through an individual's mind from there on out until the time they die? Now, this is a period of time that has always been denied by people. We don't like to think about it. We know that it is a great trauma. We know that we do not want it to happen in our life. We do know that we do not want it to happen in our family's life. Doctors do not know how to deal with it. Courses are not taught on the subject. And in fact, a couple years ago is really the only time that anybody has tried to do any scientific study of the matter to see really what happens to an individual when they die. Now, all of us know that when we get married, we have certain psychological changes take place. We understand that we have psychological changes take place in middle age. We have psychological changes take place in our older years.
And we also have some very, very definite stages that we go through when an individual dies. Now, first of all, then, in this period right here, and this may be all that we're dealing with today, but if it is, then next week we will get into the Bible aspect of what is God's answer to this particular problem. But I want to suggest to you now that as we come down here to this part of where we die, unless you are killed in a violent accident where your life is snuffed out immediately, unless you happen to have some type of a thing that happened to my sister where she had that aneurysm and immediately went unconscious within a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, then if you are not fortunate enough to die a death of that nature, and if your death is coming upon you in a slow, terminal way, then these are the stages that you will go through. All human beings go through these stages. Now we have to understand that in God's great wisdom, God created man so that he reacts to certain things in certain ways. We all do the same thing. God made man so that, let's say, man faints at certain things. Whenever pain becomes unbearable, God made it so that man just faints or blacks out momentarily so that he can emotionally comprehend or emotionally adjust himself to this pain. If you are in an automobile accident, you are going to go into shock. It doesn't make any difference whether you like it or not, but if there's a serious automobile accident, you will go into shock. God made man's mind in that way. We go into shock at various reactions, at things that our emotions are not capable of accepting momentarily. As you well know, when I went to the Philippines and walked into that, and all of a sudden, in about a 2-day period, Jim there is trying to show me everything in Manila, and it was too much for me. I went into what is known as cultural shock. I lost all feeling for my family. I had no desire to come home. My wife and my children were just names. Had somebody come in and said, "Your wife has died," I would probably have said, "Well, that's too bad." That is about all of the feeling that I would have had at that time. In my diary, I wrote down there that my feeling was coming back. It is an awesome thing, something that you have to go through to understand the shock that you have when you see all of a sudden conditions that your mind cannot accept. Poverty and illness and pain and filth and things that are just too much. God made man's mind so he can cope with it. So, I went into shock. I was able to teach my classes. I could teach the classes as well as I could teach them here. But as far as having feelings and having all of the other things to be able to function in society as I would here, I became a numb zombie. And I'm glad that God gave man that ability. Now, when we see something that we just is a trauma to us, God made man so he does things like that, so he can cope with it. Now, when death comes, God made man a creature so that certain things are going to happen to you just as surely as night follows day. This sermon, really, I determined that I was going to preach it when I went back to my sister's funeral and when my brother-in-law was in this great traumatic experience, and when he came up to him and he said, "Lowell, do you ever preach on what it means to die? I mean, do you ever preach and tell the people what they go through in death and what the family goes through?" And I got to thinking, I preach on marriage. I tell people what it's like to get married. I tell them some of the good things, and I tell them some of the bad things. And I try to prepare them so that they can go into marriage in a realistic way. But death? No. This will be my first lesson that ever preach on this particular subject. The first time, really, that I know of anybody that trying to prepare people, really, in the pulpit, for what death really is like. But we need to understand, what we say today is something that you will go through unless you have a quick or a violent death. So now, as we start here, I'm going to use this and read some statements in here to kind of give us an idea from a lady who has studied this, a nurse who has studied this firsthand. In fact, I think that it is a doctor, I'm not sure, that has studied this firsthand and made it her life's work to see really what happens to individuals. All right, now, as you start out in your terminal illness, If the doctor walks in and tells you that you have cancer and there is nothing more that he can do, the first step that is going to be is a step of denial. You are going to deny that fact. You are not going to accept it and say, well, okay, this is what I thought it was, and I'm ready to die. Now, it's very easy for all of us to think that we will. It was very easy for me to believe that I could go over to the Philippines, go through all of that, nothing would bother me. Very easy for me to believe that. But you cannot do it. Very easy for me to believe that I can be strong enough so that a doctor can tell me tomorrow that I have 6 months to live. And I then will say I accept the fact very graciously. But it has been a proven fact that everybody will go through a denial period. Now, sometimes it will last longer than other times. She said, among the over 200 dying patients we have interviewed, most reacted to the awareness of terminal illness at first with the statement, no, not me, it cannot be true. Now, if you don't make the statement, that really is what you're going to feel. All right, then as we move on, I'm just going to move on and read some statements and we'll make some observations here. Patients will make the statement, doctor come in and tell them that they found cancer, and then they will say, oh, I'm thankful it was benign. In other words, they will immediately say, it was not malignant. Now, she talks about what the doctor can say and so forth. He can simply say, I wish that that were true, and then silently sit with her for a while and not run off. Such a patient may pretend not to know for several days. It would be cruel for a physician to force her to accept the fact when she clearly communicates that she is not yet ready to hear it. The fact that he has told her once will be sufficient to maintain confidence in the doctor. Such a patient will seek him out later when she is able and strong enough to face the possible fatal outcome of her illness. In other words, we need to understand this ourselves, that this is what we will go through, it's what our loved ones will go through, and that is that when they reject and they say, no, not me, do not come back and say, yes, it's you. Can't you understand? This is malignant. The whole idea is that if you tell me that I have cancer, I have 6 months to live, and I say, no, not me, I will know it. But my mind, the mind that God gave me, is not willing to accept this emotionally yet. It may take me several days. It may take me a few weeks. But if I am told, I will know, and I will have confidence then, that you have told me the truth. Now again, it says, our interviews have shown that all patients have kept the door open to the possibility of continued existence. Not one of them has at all times maintained that there is no wish to live at all. Some of these I'm going to have to look at to see really which is worthy of reading and which is not. When we ask our patients how they have been told, we learn that all the patients knew they had terminal illness anyway, whether they were explicitly told or not, but depended greatly on the physician to present the news in an acceptable manner. Generally, people understand this anyway. So, you say, well, how do you tell people? You say, well, the important one is our own attitude and ability to face terminal illness and death. Patients will react to it differently. If you are the type of person that goes through this life rejecting facts, and you will not accept reality, and there are a lot of people this way, it will take you a longer time to accept the fact that you do have a terminal illness. However, if you are a pragmatic person, a person that takes things as they come, then in a very few hours or a very few days, you will adjust to that and accept, okay, I am the one, I am going to die. Now, the next thing is, the second stage is anger. After you have decided and accepted the fact mentally that you are going to die, you will become angry. And it said the first stage of denial cannot be maintained any longer. It is replaced by feelings of anger, rage, envy, and resentment. The logical next question becomes, why me? Let me read you an illustration. As one of our patients, the Dr. G, puts it, I suppose most anybody in my position would look at somebody else and say, well, why couldn't it have been him? And this has crossed my mind several times. An old man whom I have known ever since I was a little kid came down the street. He was 82 years old. He is of no earthly use as far as we mortals can tell. He's rheumatic. He's a cripple. He's dirty. Just not the type of person you would like to be. And the thought hit me strongly. Now, why couldn't it have been old George instead of me? Now, obviously, all of us have heard people make this statement. Why me? Why this young child? Why in middle age? Whatever it is. Why me? This is a question that is always going to hit. Now, rather lengthy reading, which I think is very important for us to understand. In contrast to the stage of denial, this stage of anger is very difficult to cope with from the viewpoint of family and staff. The reason for this is the fact that this anger is displaced in all directions and projected into the environment at times almost at random. The doctors are just no good. They just don't know what tests to require and what diet to prescribe. They keep the patients too long in the hospital. They don't respect their wishes or regard special privileges. In other words, they're saying that at this time, we will lash out at everybody that tries to help us. Doctors, families, friends, nobody likes us. It's everybody's fault. Now, again, the problem here is that few people place themselves in the patient's position and wonder where this anger might come from. Maybe we too would be angry if all our life's activities were interrupted so prematurely. If all the building we started were to go unfinished, to be completed by someone else. If we had put hard-earned money aside to enjoy a few years of rest and enjoyment for travel and pursuing hobbies, only to be confronted with the fact that this is not for me. What else would we do with our anger but let it out on people who are most likely to enjoy all these things? Now you think about that for a moment. We don't think about death, but we always do think about things that we want to reject. When we're young, we think, I don't want to die now. When I'm 40, then that will be plenty. I don't want to live over 40. Young people at the age of 20 often make that statement, and 40 is the number that they do not care whether they live past or not. Now, we understand that as life goes on, we get into different stages of life, and really, life becomes very, very meaningful to us. And it doesn't make any difference what stage you're in, whether you're young or whether you're old. You still have something out there you've been working for all your life and great plans that you're planning on. Just think about it. I was rather amused at a little boy on Sunday here, December the 24th, sitting in front of him, and he looked up to his daddy and said, Daddy, I sure hope the Lord doesn't come today. He said, it would just be too bad with all those presents under the tree. Now, that came from a sincere heart. That little boy really meant that. He wanted to see the Lord, but not today. His whole life was wrapped up in tomorrow. If we can just live tomorrow and open those packages, then life can be terminated, and really, there's not too much, you know, to look forward to after that. Well, you can go on and on and on and on. And I can look back and I can see in my life how that I just want to live through this one stage, and then later on, it won't make much difference. You see? But I can honestly tell you that I have more to live for today than I've ever had in all of my life. I feel sorry for you young people with your kids still at home where you have to stay at home. I feel sorry for you to be tied down in this way. I look back at my life and how that things are looking in the future. And I have plans for the future that just blow your mind. I can't die now. And if next week a doctor came in and told me I had 6 months, I'd look at my wife, I'd shake my head, I'd become a little angry at her, thinking about that man that was going to take my place, spend my money, have all of my fun. Yeah. And unless she, there wouldn't be anything she could do to please me. I would find something wrong with her and something wrong with everybody else. Now, when I get as old as Steve Bolts, I don't care whether I die. See? Now, you'll have to pick it up and talk with Steve. He's 2 or 3 years older than I am. See whether life is worth living when you hit 50 or not. And I think that we'll find that whatever stage we're in, we're going to feel the same way. So get prepared. Yes, we're going to go through that stage of anger. Well, let's move on to the next then. And the next is called the bargaining stage. Here is now where we are going to make a bargain with God. This is the period of time where we determine that if only God will let me live, just for one more thing, then I'll do this. Now, she parallels this, and I think aptly so, to a little child. That a little child comes in, wants to go spend the night over at Susie's house. And first of all, it's kind of a demanding thing. You say no. They might throw a temper tantrum. They might cry and scream. You say no. Send them to their room. And then they'll generally come out, you know, and think, well, if I'll be good, Maybe they'll come out and wash the dishes or do some of those things without being told, thinking if I do something good, then I'll get rewarded for it. So at this time, man does the same thing with his life. Lord, if you'll just let me do this one more thing, then I'll dedicate my life to you. I'll never miss another service. I'll spend my money this, I'll do that. Now, this is the time when you visit a person in the hospital and when obviously they turn their attention to God. And they're telling you this. And it happens all the time. This happened to me within the last week talking to a person. How that they're going to do this, they're going to do that. It's very dogmatic, very traumatic. They have no doubts about it whatsoever. Something you've got to just have one more thing. I think a cute incident right here was that there was a woman who was told that she would not be able to live very long. They finally got her so that she said, I have to go to my oldest son's wedding. She had to live for that. Oh, if God will merely let me go to my son's wedding, then I'll be happy to die and there will be no hard feelings about it whatsoever. So they put her on medication. They finally got her. She went to the son's wedding. Had an elegant wedding. And the nurse said she came back. When she came back, she was the happiest person in the whole world and looked radiant. I wondered what her reaction would be when the time was up for which she had bargained. I will never forget the moment when she returned to the hospital. She looked tired and somewhat exhausted. And before I could say hello, she said, now don't forget, I have another son. Now, this is what we do. We never keep our bargains. We always try to postpone death by bargaining for God. We will be good if you will let us do one more thing. And so she has said, it includes an implicit promise that the patient will not ask for more if this one postponement is granted. Now listen, none of our patients have kept their promises. So when you go and you find that they're making these, understand that this is human nature. And when a person says, certainly they've turned to God, what about deathbed repentance? Well, if they die, you'll never know whether they've repented or not. But to my knowledge, I can add to this, nobody that's ever told me that in the hospital has ever come out of the hospital and kept their promises that they made to God. And that might help us answer a little bit about the validity of deathbed repentance. Now, she comes down and says, most bargains are made with God and are usually kept a secret or mentioned between the lines of a chaplain's office and so forth and so on. Now, the fourth stage. The fourth stage that we go into is depression. That as soon as we accept this or go through that stage, then we get into this particular stage. In here, she makes a good point. What we tend to forget, however, is the preparatory grief that the terminally ill person has to undergo in order to prepare himself for his final separation from this world. If I were to attempt to differentiate between these two depressions, I would regard the first one as a reactive depression and the second as a preparatory depression. The first one is different in nature and should be dealt with quite differently from the latter. Now let's look at this. There are going to be two different kinds. Up in here, there's going to be a reactive pressure, and down here is a preparatory pressure, depression. Now the reactive depression is this. That suppose that somebody tells me that my life is going to come to an end within the next few months. Alright? My reaction is, look what I've lost. Suppose they come in and they tell me, Lowell, you have cancer of the throat, and you'll never be able to preach again. You're not going to be able to do this, and you then will, your life will be taken in probably 6 months. Well, the first thing that I will come out to is, look at all that I've done to come to this point in life. Now, I'm no good anymore. I can't do what I prepared myself to do. I'm worthless. A woman who has surgery that affects her femininity in some way, she will feel that she is no longer a woman. She's lost everything that she's had. She'll never be attractive again. This is the kind of reactive situation that will cause a depression. Now, under that, cheer will work. You can cheer them up. You can say, oh yes, you're going to be beautiful. You're going to do this. You can tell them, look, this happened to Susie, and just think how happy Susie is and how beautiful she is. And you can talk and cheer and say everything's fine. And that is good at that part. But what about the preparation for dying? I now am looking ahead. You can cheer me up in the past, and you can say, "Lowell, I know somebody else that went through this. Here's how happy they are." That'll give me encouragement. But you can't say, "Lowell, I know somebody else that died, and look how happy they are." You see, now I'm preparing myself for death. And so you come in and try to be cheerful. And you say, "Oh, it's not as bad as you think. Everything's going to be okay, Lowell." It won't work. Because I know you don't want to die. I know that it's not as cheerful as you think. I know that you're lying to me. When you say everything's going to be fine, it's cheerful, oh, it's all good and all of this. Because I know that if we could exchange beds, you're not willing to lay down and say, "Oh, goody, goody, I hope I get it and I'm ready to die." So all of your cheering is hypocritical. And anybody understands that. Everybody knows that. So that is not the approach to take. The approach to take that will help me feel good is for you to understand the seriousness of it. Maybe just hold my hand. Tell me you love me. Tell me that you'll stand by my side all the way, whatever's necessary. I have a battle now that you've never been through and that you can no longer cheer me up over. The only thing you can do is let me know that it's agonizing to you too. It hurts me. And if it cheers you, and my wife comes in so cheerful about what good things we've got, my logic is, I'm going to die and it's all good. And it's not going to turn out good in my thoughts concerning her. This is the period of time of when you can just sit down and hold my hand for an hour. Not say a word. Let me understand you are by my side all the way. That you understand. That really is about the only thing that we can do in a case like this. Now, well, I think that is enough. I was going to read you some statements in here, but it pretty well covers what I was going to read. All right, at this time, she said, "Our interviews reveal a readiness to separate himself from this life. It was sad that he was forced to struggle for life when he was ready to prepare himself to die. It is this discrepancy between the patient's wish and readiness and the expectation of those in his environment which causes the greatest grief and turmoil in our patients. They should know that this type of depression is necessary, that is, people that visit, and beneficial if the patient is to die in a stage acceptable and peace, of acceptance and peace. Only patients who have been able to work through their anguish and anxieties are able to achieve this stage. If this reassurance could be shared with their families, they too could be spared much unnecessary anguish." What she's getting at is, you have to go through this before now you're ready to get down here in stage 5. And stage 5 is the acceptance stage. That's the acceptance of where you say, "All right, I accept the fact that my life will soon be taken from this earth." Now, the point that she's making is, if you deny this, and if I'm in this stage in death, and you come in and you deny it, and all my family denies it, and they come in all happy and cheerful, and, "Dad, everything's going to be all right," then you are trying to overcome and deprive me of going through this stage to where I can get into this stage right here. And so that's why that you would need to give me assurance and hold my hand and silence, really. As cheer is there, silent is really the word that you would put there. That is where something means really so much to an individual. To know when to speak and know when not to speak. The next is acceptance. And in acceptance, it says, if a patient has had enough time, not a sudden, unexpected death, has been given some help in working through the previously described stages, he will reach a stage during which he is neither depressed nor angry about his fate. The stage of acceptance. He's not depressed. He's not angry. Now, he goes ahead to talk here, she does, that it is not a cheerful stage at this time. It's not cheerful and it's not happy. But it is a stage of acceptance of where you know that finally it is really going to happen. I will never forget the occasion that I had with Thurston Kimbrell, a preacher at Bremerton, when he was dying with cancer. And I would go over and pick him up at the docks and take him up to the doctor and spend the day with him and then take him back down, put him on the boat for him to go back over to Bremerton. And how that he would go through these various stages and how that he denied this and he would carry a plan with him. and have to carry the pan because he would vomit in the pan walking up the street. He finally would walk to the side and he would fall against the buildings like this in order to get wherever he was going to go from the boat to my car. And at all the times like this, he'd turn to me and he'd say, "Oh, buddy, this is not going to whip me. You just watch me, boy. I'll be back preaching again." Oh, he'd just be talking, you see, like that. And then there was a time, sitting in the room waiting on the doctor's announcement, that he looked over at me and he said, "Well, old buddy," he said, "I guess you know you've got a job to do." I said, "What's that?" He said, "Well, it's coming." He said, "I want you to preach my funeral." And so we could talk about death. But you can't talk about it until it comes to a certain time. But there was a time when acceptance came. He knew that his life was terminated on the face of this earth. And so that acceptance then is a period of time when you, it says, acceptance should not be mistaken for a happy stage. It is almost void of feelings. It is as if the pain had gone. The struggle is over and there comes time for the final rest before the long journey. As one patient phrased it, "This is also the time during which the family needs usually more help, understanding, and support than the patient himself." We need to understand that. Next week we're going to talk about... No, we're not either. Next week we're going to get God's answers to these problems. And the following week we're going to talk about what it's like for you to lose a loved one. And then we will be able to get on in then to the future, what life is about in the future. But here, the patient's family at this time needs more help than the patient. The patient is ready to go. This again. It says, "When the dying patient has found some peace and acceptance, his circle of interest diminishes. He wishes to be left alone, or at least not stirred by the news and problems of the outside world. Visitors are often not desired, and if they come, the patient is no longer in a talkative mood. He often requests limitation on the number of people and offers and prefers short visits. This is the time when the television is off. Our communications then become more nonverbal than verbal. The patient may make a gesture of the hand to invite us to sit down for a while. He may just hold her hand or ask us to sit in silence. Such moments of silence may be the most meaningful communication for people who are not uncomfortable in the presence of a dying person." It's important for us to try to get ourselves so that we can be comfortable or not uncomfortable in the presence of a dying person. We may listen together to the song of a bird from the outside. Our presence may just confirm that we are going to be around until the end. We may just let him know that it is all right to say nothing when the important things are taken care of and it's only a question of time until he can close his eyes forever. It may reassure him that he's not left alone when he's no longer talking, and a pressure of a hand, a look, a leaning back in the pillow may say more than many noisy words. Now, it is at this time when the patient rather unusual thing that we might not be familiar with. Over here, she says this: "There are a few patients who fight to the end, who struggle and keep a hope that makes it almost impossible to reach this stage. They will fight in this. And a lot of times, it's encouraged for the family and everybody. Be a man. Don't give up." And everybody denies. And if you've got a fighter, he will deny it all the way through. And here's what generally happens. When you skip these other stages, finally, you come down here to accept that, and it's just all of a sudden that you accept it. And she says, they're the ones who will one day say, "I just can't make it anymore. The day they stop fighting, the fight is over." In other words, the harder they struggle to avoid the inevitable death, the more they try to deny it, the more difficult it will be for them to reach the final stage of acceptance. And she goes ahead to say, generally, when the day that they say, I can make it no more, most patients are dead within 24 hours. And so, we need to understand, God made man so he goes through these things. And if we can understand them as we are going through them, it will help us just a little bit. I'll tell you some of my reactions in my sister's death of me going through them. And I knew what I would go through. I knew the stages. I went in as a man that was knowledgeable of what would happen. And so I go in and say, it will not happen to me. But it did. And we'll talk about the reactions. These are things that a person just has to go through. Now, this is the point of where we have the goodbye that are given. At this particular period of time, the patient in his stage of acceptance, where he knows he's going to die, will start telling his friends goodbye. Now, he doesn't do this by saying, "Goodbye, don't ever come back again." But by some statement, "Well, goodbye, You know, it's been good knowing you. I'll see you later. See you on the other side. Or they'll make some statement. And what they're doing is saying goodbye to you. Don't come back and see me anymore. Don't make it any harder than I have to. I'm telling you goodbye from this life. So it starts out with the friends that you have. The close friends will be the next ones. Then generally the children will be the next ones. That the parent will say, tell them goodbye, and hoping that they will not come back. And then the spouse will be the last that you say goodbye to. And then finally death is on its way. Now it's just as sure as night follows day that these things follow in our life. And then the other thing that I would want to put in is that there always, down to the end, remains somewhat of a hope. There is a hope that somehow, in all the way through this, the doctors will find some new cure so that we might be able to be cured. She says, no matter what we call it, we found that in our patients, that all our patients maintained a little bit of it and were nourished by it in especially difficult times. Said, if a patient stops expressing hope, it is usually a sign of imminent death. They may say, doctor, I think I've had it, or I guess this is it. And then I was thinking that this is a place where she gives the hours that they would be gone. So she comes down to the conclusion. It might be helpful if more people would talk about death and dying as an intrinsic part of life, just as they do not hesitate to mention when somebody is expecting a baby. We don't hesitate to talk about, here's what it's like to have a new child in the house. Your whole household will be changed. Here's what it's like. When you get married, here's what it's like. When you're going to move off somewhere, if you were going to move off into a different section of the country, I'd say, here's what you'll find when you move to that different section of the country. But every one of us, one day, unless our life comes to an end in an accident, quickly, we'll go through these stages. Now, let us be prepared for them. And I wish that we had the time now. We don't. This is the end of the lesson. But if we had the time, now I would want to get to the Bible part of where Christ is the answer to all of these things. To where a Christian will be able to go through these in a way of which a heathen will not be able to understand and comprehend and will not find that comfort. You remember that we're told in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4 that we're to sorrow not as the rest who have no hope. There is a great deal of hope when a Christian is dying. And of course, in later lessons, we'll find about the hope after he is dead. But these suggestions are made today for the basis then of next week's sermon. We, next week, will not go through the different things. We will list what is up here on the board, and then we'll start putting scriptures out to the side to show what it means to be a Christian in the day you die. Should there be one in our audience today that understands that your life is not in harmony with God's will, today that you need to be washed in the precious blood of the Son of God, would you let it be known as we stand and as we sing the first stanza of the song?